Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 520.GE0615, certificate number 35593. General Mills.
General Mills presents.
Hello, Alex.
Hello, John.
So, as listeners to our Get to Know Me addenda episode will know, you're a comedy writer and TikTok superstar. Based in Los Angeles.
Niche famous
superstar. Yep. And if I understand our preview correctly, you're an enormous fan of me personally and of my work as a broadcaster.
I'm very familiar with everything you've ever done. No follow-up questions, please.
That's marvelous. So as a TikToker, am I right that you now live in a palatial Los Angeles mid-century modern home looking out over the city?
I know that the real estate market is bad in Seattle, but even TikTok money can't get you a two-bedroom house in LA.
Oh, man. What's devastating about that to me is that in the early days of rock and roll touring, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, Los Angeles was so cheap.
Yeah.
It was like ridiculously cheap to live there. And it always felt, and Seattle was cheap then too, but it just seemed to me at the time like, oh, there, Los Angeles could never be expensive because there are houses that stretch to the horizon in every direction, like Eagle Rock. Who even could find Eagle Rock?
Yeah, it hurts me to hear that. There was a house recently. There was like a little two bedroom house in our neighborhood that we thought was maybe an opportunity for us, and we looked at the listing, and it was $1.8 million.
Oh my God!
And I almost forgot to mention, it had already burned down. It was a burned down two-bedroom house that in its current state as a pile of rubble and a garage was $1.8 million. That's the LA real estate market.
God, that's insane.
I know.
I think about, you know, not specifically $1.8 million, but I do think about the amount of money that's out there that is kind of meaningless to some people. Like $1.8 million is more money than if everyone in my family combined our money and all the things we own and tried to make a pile of it that we were going to not just live on, but like retire with. $1.8 million seems like so aspirational, but there are people even within 2 miles of where I am for whom $1.8 million is just sort of like one of their accounts.
Yeah, and we should probably eat them. I mean, this is a metaphor mostly. I'm a vegetarian, so I would be fine if we just composted them or something. I don't really need a piece personally. And also, I should say, like, I do feel bad whenever I don't want to like this be like stolen valor of like not being able to afford life. I did recently throw away a lotion bottle when I probably could have taken the stick out and got some off it, but I was like, I'm doing well now. I don't unscrew the stick anymore. So I'm like, I'm between needing to get the last bit of lotion out and buying a house.
As a TikTok debunker, how much of your career is just vibes?
It started vibes based, and I had an early hit where I mentioned something about Penn and Teller, the magicians. And not realizing the full power of TikTok when something goes well, Penn Jillette's wife showed up in the comments. and took issue with something I'd said. And I decided, and even though in hindsight, I do think I was right, but I have decided the vibes-based videos had to go, and I had to be much more, I have more studies that I show on screen than I used to. So I'm trying to avoid angry partners by not just relying on vibes.
I was a great admirer of Penn and Teller, although, you know, I find Penn Jillette extremely annoying, as everyone I think does.
His politics abhorrent.
Well, and that's the thing about his politics. At one point, he was doing something, you know, and he said some things where I was like, what?
Yeah.
That's really outrageous. And ever since then, I've had, you know, he's kind of like Jeremy Clarkston, where it's like, I used to really like this show. And now I can still watch Woody Allen movies, but you know, it's like, you kind of, I'm not sure to what degree you have to hold your nose, but yeah,
I find Woody Allen's a separate question. I find Penn and Teller's magic is delightful. I do think probably I would get along better with Teller. But Penn was a juggler who became a famous magician. And if you were like, that's the key to an intellectually rigorous life, I would love to hear what he thinks about how governments should work. That might be a little bit on you. You're
saying that about the two of us, who presumably between the two of us, we have, I don't know, fewer than two PhDs in history.
Yes. Yes.
And so let's not go too far down the juggler route.
I think we have proven ourselves to be rigorous intellectuals in a way that perhaps the magic of Penn and Teller hasn't always. I mean, they did have a show debunking things, so like obviously I'm in their genre.
To pivot now to your show, General Mills. Am I right that Cedar Rapids is a General Mills like a company town?
I don't know, and I don't care.
Ah.
So this is going to be about a very specific part of General Mills that is not their cereal capabilities.
It's not the mills, is what you're saying.
It's not the mills.
Okay.
I do know that they started in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on the falls there, and that's what and their across the river rival Pillsbury also did, although they both are the same company now. But this is not about their cereal manufacturing. This is about the other stuff they got up to with that sweet Captain Crunch money.
Now, are you going to tell me that General Mills is some kind of defense contractor where they build submarines and have their own security forces?
Of course that. But it's also more interesting. So you're in the right ballpark. I am generally very interested in corporate side quests. So I like this started a couple years ago when the NBA Finals was in Denver, and there was like they play in the Ball Arena, and I know them as a jar company, and my wife like saw the logo and was like, how do they make tanks? How do they afford an arena on jar money? And it turns out Ball Jar had gotten sick of making jars and made space telescopes and laser range finding for missiles and like all kinds of stuff.
But that kind of checks out, right? They're grinding glass already, or they're manufacturing glass.
Yeah, it's glass adjacent. Quaker Oats, you may know, also made the Willy Wonka movie as a way to bank shot into candy. So those are adjacent. But General Mills went unbelievably far away from the mill. But this is the main takeaway from reading about the history of General Mills is more general than I even imagined. This mill could use some focus.
And when they started as a mill, they weren't even making cereal, were they? Were they making like animals?
They were
not.
They were milling wheat, and they were at the time the main innovation was using the power of the waterfall, and then certain the kinds of rocks and ceramics and plates that would grind wheat in a certain way that made them take off. It was mostly the power of the waterfall in Minneapolis. But I got a lot to cover, so let's get away from this mill. I'm not talking about cereal anymore.
Let's get away from the mill.
I warned you early on in our other chat that I am wide and not deep. And I'm going to have a lot of information where a follow-up question will only get you disappointment. So just be ready for that.
That's fine. I will continue to answer or to ask them, and you can reply to them any way you want. You can say, I don't know anyway, or you can like fake an answer.
Great.
Okay.
Great. So did you know that they found the Titanic?
General Mills?
General Mills found the Titanic. Yeah.
Come on. It was found by James Cameron.
James came a little later. Did you know they also caused the Roswell, New Mexico incident in 1947 that created an alien panic?
No, you're just baiting me. This is bananas.
And they also made Olive Garden. All three of those are true. And
this isn't one of those, like, one of these things or two of these things are true.
I wish it was two truths and a lie. All three of those are true. And that's what we're talking about. So let's go down first. We'll go up, we'll go up first. We'll come back to down. We'll go up first.
All right. Let's go up.
So you're familiar with the Roswell story. You know what really happened in Roswell, right?
All too well. And I have been to Roswell.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So you know that it was really a project about horny whales originally.
Well, let's see. Maybe when I read the plaque in Roswell, it didn't mention horny whales. It said something about a weather balloon.
Yeah, balloons.
But
yeah.
Also, it said something about it being like a craft, and they took that technology and ended up building Terminators.
Yeah, so these are both good pieces of information to have from a plaque. Also, does not do follow-up questions, so we have that in common.
Okay.
So to understand Roswell and to understand General Mills, you have to understand the way sound travels through water, which not the whole version of it, but just that the depth, the pressure and the temperature all affect how the sound moves. And because of that, there is a depth of water. There's like a chunk of water where sound goes way farther than anywhere else.
So is it some kind of bell curve where at close to the surface, the sound does not travel far, and then in the middle, it's like a sweet spot, and then down below?
It's because of the pressure and temperature coming together that, yes, it's not exactly a bell curve, but there's a part where if the sound goes up, it gets reflected back down because it moves faster down, and if it goes down, it gets reflected back up. And so there's a channel of water. We call it the SOFAR channel. Which is the sound fixing and ranging channel, because sound travels really farther. But whales found this long before we did. So fin whales, horny fin whales, will swim down to that exact depth and sing their horny songs.
Sure.
And then whales all over the world can hear them, and they come rushing.
So,
or they don't, but they can hear the song from it. So they use that as a communication thing.
Is this a thing where like lower frequency sound travels differently through a different slice of the ocean than higher frequency sound, or is it just like there's an area that's like a series of tubes?
It is much more like a series of tubes. I don't know how much the frequency affects it, but there is like, and it is obviously curve, like it's not exactly just this temperature, but there's a sweet spot that the whales found, and we found it too. And some scientists found it, but they found it and thought, like, right around the time where there was some really interesting wars going on.
Yes.
And they thought, I bet this would be really useful for spying on submarines.
Yes.
And for hearing ocean vessels, ocean atomic testing later. So the U.S. government secretly dropped a lot of microphones down to exactly that level.
Of course.
To listen, which is called the SOSUS array. And that's an array of hydrophones spying on that. Very useful for submarine stuff.
Is this a situation where the whales taught us this because we learned to communicate with them by alien technology that we seized in Roswell?
So you would be, but this was the wrong order. We did find this channel before we get to Roswell, but the Roswell thing happens because of this. So we hear we find this channel, not because of the whales. We've figured out first because of math, I believe, and then proved it. Math. But there's this cool thing you can do when you have that, like, long, like when you have a series of hydrophones, which is you can triangulate. So you can put a couple of microphones, hear the sound at slightly different times, and know where it came from in the world. So you can spy on stuff. That's sort of the way GPS works, where you have three coordinates. You know exactly how far each one took to get the sound to you. You can measure some stuff.
Very Alex, can you explain why I have never heard of this before? Because I've heard of a lot of things, but I did not know there was a temperature column of water where things went up and bounced back, and things went down and bounced up. Why is this being kept secret from us?
I mean, certainly it was classified for some period of time because we were using it to spy on submarines, although it's been the scientific community instead for a long time. The reason you haven't heard about it is because who cares? This is not very related to your life. You're not making sounds deep underwater very often. We do also use it to like understand like undersea volcanoes and stuff, but mostly fish stuff. None of this was related to you, but it was really useful for the military.
Sure.
And they actually had a way of finding a downed pilot where the pilot could throw a bomb, a SOFAR bomb, overboard. It would go down to about that depth and blow up. And they would know from the different microphones exactly where that pilot was missing. So it was they built a system of finding a downed pilot. So we have this. And the scientists who figured out, because of math, that channel of water, they thought, you know what else is like water, but dry? The air. So if there's a sound channel in the water, air also has different layers of pressure and temperature.
Yes.
And they did the math and figured out there must be a sound channel in the air. And it turns out there is.
The math.
And so they thought we could spy on Russian nuclear tests because the sound would go up, it would get caught in the channel, it would spread out. All we need is that array of microphones in different locations to triangulate. So they took some weather balloons and some microphones and put them up in the air and tried to just keep them aloft.
That was no weather balloon. Is that what you're telling me?
It was a weather balloon attached to microphones and listening equipment and triangulation equipment. But the thing is,
now wait a minute. You're saying it's a weather balloon because it just goes up into the weather. I assumed that a weather balloon was made to measure the weather, not listen in on Russian nuclear tests.
I guess that maybe there's a slight bit of category fraud happening here. The same balloon that you could measure weather high up, you could take off the weather thing and put on a microphone.
I see. Okay.
And it would be the same, you know, plastic balloon that was useful for that.
Right. So it's like a surfing nuclear sub. It is a nuclear sub, but you can also surf behind it if you drive it fast enough.
It would be weird to rename it just for that one other activity for occasionally. So, but you can see as a sharp scientific mind, holding a microphone underwater is much easier than keeping it in the exact height of the air indefinitely.
Yeah.
And knowing exactly where it was. So we were trying to use this to spy on Russians by building these sound equipment, putting them on balloons, putting them up in the sky. The problem is extremely difficult to keep things up there. So one of them crashed. And that was the balloon that crashed near Roswell, New Mexico. And it had a little carriage under it made out of balsa wood and tape. And it had a bunch of microphones and some other recording equipment. And that was the thing. And it was so classified that the people in the army base nearby that were first brought this did not know either. Mm-hmm. They were like, we've never heard of this. Yes. We're not allowed to know stuff like this. So they said, first, we found a craft. And then later, somebody called them from the Pentagon and was like, hey, no. And so then they said, actually, we found nothing. And it was a cover-up. It was a genuine cover-up.
Right.
It was just covering up spying on Russian nukes
We know aliens. A couple of things, and one of them is the intelligence officer that is stationed at a base in New Mexico is probably not the most media trained or smartest.
That's not
one.
Where you put your best TV people, correct?
But let me ask you this. I would think if you were measuring Russian nuclear tests that you would send balloons up, say, for instance, from Berlin or France.
This is the great
even?
Thing about the sound channel. You don't have to be nearby. The same way the whales are sending their songs much farther by hitting the sound channel, putting a balloon up over Berlin is much riskier, much more likely you'll get caught. But if you do it over New Mexico, you can still hear nuclear tests because they'll go into the sound channel. So you put them up in safe places near testing facilities in America, and you can still get the same amount of information. It turns out that was a huge pain in the ass. It was not worth it. And after that crash, we basically scrapped this program and figured out you could also listen to nuclear tests from earthquakes. So you can just put seismometers in America, triangulate, learn the same thing.
And that's what we typically see is like, oh, Tsar Bomba was detected by this, these seismic. So this is a thing. This is a technology that was kind of first discovered either during World War II or prior to it, but really employed during the war. And now it's a Cold War.
Correct.
A superpower.
Correct. It was first discovered in the early 40s I believe it was not originally trying to do military research, but was immediately available. Obvious that it would be useful for that, but I don't remember exactly. I do remember.
It was whale porn. It was some horny scientists.
It could have just been, like whale audio books and stuff.
This summer is my mom's 92nd birthday, and she's been trying to get some of her stories down, some of her, some of her tales from her childhood, some of the tales from her life. But the challenge is like thinking of those prompts sitting at home. You know, you're not always going to be inspired with like, oh, what's a good story to tell? I mean, it's one thing to wake up in the middle of the night and go, I've got to tell that story. Most of the time you sit down and you think, what am I going to write about? You know, I have a story from my childhood, a story from the middle of my life. And that's why we've been so lucky to have discovered Storyworth. Every week, Storyworth sends her a question about her life and she responds however she wants. She can email them back. She can send them a voice recording. Storyworth makes it easy for her so she can focus on the joy of remembering and reflecting. And I can help pick the questions. I mean, we sometimes choose from pre-written questions. Sometimes we write our own. Storyworth sometimes creates personalized questions based on her life. And here's what Storyworth does. Storyworth compiles everything, her words, her photos, and puts it all into a beautiful hardcover book. Now, what's cool about this is Storyworth has created over 1 million books, and nicely, it has over 50,000 five-star reviews. But this year, and this has been great for us, Storyworth's unlimited plan allows you to buy one plan, and you can give Storyworth memoirs to friends and family all year. It comes with all their newest features. It's multiple full-color book copies. You can have this as a Mother's Day gift. You can have it as a Father's Day gift. You could do it yourself. You could start working on your own memoir by using Storyworth. And with the unlimited plan, there's a 60-minute long guided phone call that you have with Storyworth to help you get your stories out. Honestly, it's like being interviewed. So I'm really glad that Storyworth is sponsoring the Omnibus, and follow my lead, and this year give your mom a gift that helps her reflect on her life with fresh perspective and gives your whole family the gift of her stories. Mother's Day this year is Sunday, May 10th. Order right now and save up to $20 at storyworth.com/omnibus. That's $20 off at storyworth.com/omnibus.
The reason I tell you that is because the balloon necessary for that, the weather balloon in question, or surfing nuclear balloon if you prefer, was invented by General Mills.
Why?
So General Mills had too much cereal money, and in the 1940s, their
business... Can you say there's such a thing as too much cereal money?
At some point, you're like, well, we can't build more factories. We're already selling as much. Everyone's getting cereal as much as we can. We have all of this profit coming in. We should try other things, specifically things that have a government funding source, just like the people that, like, if you're going to have a military hobby. So General Mills had an aeronautics division. And in 1946, they invented a high altitude weather balloon using plastics. And they made very, very good ones. And they were part of the program that was used to hang microphones in the sound channel to spy on Russian nuclear people, the nuclear tests. The serial people built that balloon.
Now, I know that this was an era of materials science, but you would assume that that balloon would be made by DuPont or someone that was already working in plastics and not the Captain Crunch company, who's like, you know what, let's just full on just, I don't know what, recruit scientists or like go out into the streets of St. Paul?
And presumably probably stole some from DuPont or that kind of thing. But yeah, they were like, we should build up our materials department as well and compete on this. And then it's military contracting work. And as you know, famously, to the lowest bidder. So if you have so much profit from your main job as a serial, you're a hobbyist when it comes to spy balloons, you can probably undercut DuPont a little bit with your excellent array of balloons.
Right.
And so they did.
Is the plastic at all, is it all petroleum-based plastic, or is some of it derived from corn syrup and other materials that General Mills already
had? I know
you
really want this to fit closer into the General Mills. I mean, I'm not a material scientist. I believe them to be made out of petroleum. If you're going to make it out of corn, that would be hard now, let alone in 1946.
But it'd be cool.
It would be cool. And I'm sure it is possible at some level. But yeah, this was early plastics was just straight petroleum work.
Okay.
And they had enough money to just do it. So they invented the balloon that like the piece that crashed that we saw that had the craft attached to it. But the balloon was from Project Mogul, which was a balloon designed by General Mills for America to spy on its neighbors.
So maybe if we'd paid a little bit more for DuPont to do it, we would not even know about it now, and there wouldn't be like UFO conspiracy theories, and people would be normal.
It's very possible. I don't want to, this, I'm very clear early on with you. This is not sullying the name of General Mills. Right. I think they made really good balloons.
Oh,
and in
okay.
fact, their balloons were continually, they were used for other science and for weather monitoring and some other spy work. They also, we also did float balloons with just other regular spy equipment over, over Russia and over other parts of Europe. And we used good General Mills balloons. They do good balloons. Like
yeah.
the craziest part about, and the reason why, one of the reasons I think the story is so compelling about General Mills side hustles, they were good at them.
Hmm.
This wasn't like a crazy person in the lab who's like, we've got all this corn money, let's make plastic, and then it's terrible. This is like, they hired good scientists and did good work. So it had, I guess, decent corporate culture that made that possible. And they invented some incredible things. But what their thing that went up is impressive, but not as impressive as their work going down. Do you remember what a broken arrow is?
Yes, it's a nuclear missile or bomb that is off the, as we would have once said, off the reservation, but it has gone rogue and it's like out,
lost it.
Out in the world. We lost it. Right?
Lost nukes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I never actually watched the 90s film Broken Arrow, but I remember the trailer where they explained that. And then a guy says, it's really alarming that it's happened enough that we gave it a name. And that's all I need. I think that's all you really need to know about it. Without, I'm sure the rest of the movie was fine. We had the government acknowledged from 1950 to 1980, 32 broken arrow incidents.
I did not know that.
We lose so many more nukes than you would like to believe. It happened a lot. And that's 32 acknowledged by the government. I'm
right.
not a conspiracy theorist, but maybe they haven't gotten around to telling us everything that ever happened. We've lost at least 32 nuclear devices. Not always bombs. Sometimes it's nuclear reactors, but both. Yeah.
Can you... other than the ones that were that like sank to the bottom of the ocean and we know where they are, we just can't get them. How many of those did we never find?
I believe of the acknowledged ones, we know where all of them
okay,
are to
good.
Some level.
That's important.
They were lost at some point. The ones that I'm going to talk about, and certainly all the ones that I read about, we have some knowledge, but we lost them for a time, and then we had to go on an adventure. Another program that we did during the Cold War that involved keeping things in the sky forever was a program called Chrome Dome. And I don't know if you remember this. It's basically the program from Dr. Strangelove. But the idea was, we want nukes in planes all the time so that if they kill the whole country, we can still get them back.
Right. I was explaining this to my daughter the other day, that so much of our Cold War policy was just about getting them back. Not because, I mean, to a certain extent, because of the mutually assured destruction would presumably, you know, inhibit them. But if they did actually just decide to do it, launch the missiles, we still needed to spend billions to just ensure that we would get revenge from beyond the grave.
Yes, we had so Chrome Dome was a large revenge from beyond the grave plan. And so, but to keep B-52 bombers flying around in the sky 24/7, you have the same problem that you had with the balloons, which is just like stuff crashes. Keeping planes up, refueling in midair is very dangerous. So during Chrome Dome alone, there was an incident where we accidentally dropped two nukes on Goldsboro, South Carolina.
Right.
We accidentally dropped two nukes on Yuba City, California.
I didn't know about that.
Two nukes on Savage Mountain, Maryland. We dropped four on Greenland, and crucial to our story, we dropped four on Palomares, in Spain. We dropped four on Spain in 1966, and most of the time, it was some sort of crash, but none of the times did the nuclear part of the bomb go off. Usually, the regular explosive would go off. Sometimes we spread radioactive material, but none, like, I don't have to tell you that Spain still exists. So we know that the four nukes did not go off, or you would have heard a lot more
about
that. Right.
The fuse has to be armed, and that's a whole process that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So those were all Broken Arrow incidents where we found the bombs, but there was a time where the bombs were lost.
Yeah.
And so the one in Spain in 1966 was four nukes, and it was a refueling accident, which is all in terms of like the revenge, like people died in a lot of these crashes. So we're like, our soldiers are dying to keep this potential of killing you later,
right?
Which is also stressful.
But, you know, that's collateral damage. You know, thank them for their service. But, you know, come on.
Yes. Yes, it is. I think that sucks. But that is the way the military behaves. You're correct. Yeah. So we dropped these four bombs on Spain in 1966.
Now, this is Franco's Spain, too. It's still a closed fascist country, arguably.
It is tough. And one of them actually did. There was a thing where one of them spread a bunch of radioactive material and the government was like, it's totally fine. And one of the government officials like swam in the beach on the beach to show you that it was fine. And it definitely was not fine. So it was definitely not great for the people of Spain. But one of those four bombs, the parachute opened, the wind caught it, and it disappeared.
Uh-oh.
And we did not know some period of time. We did not know where it went.
It didn't have an Apple tag on it.
Exactly. We had no tag on it. So then, but we saw that it went out towards the sea. It wasn't on land. So we need to go find it. Mm-hmm. We need a really good submarine. And guess who makes a kick submarine?
No.
General Mills.
I said that at the beginning of the show, but I was kidding.
I know. You said submarine and I was really annoyed. I thought maybe you'd actually read ahead on my notes, but you didn't. No, General Mills invented a submarine called Alvin. So the Navy had been looking for a specific deep sea submarine that could do certain kinds of adventuring and searching. And they had put out an RFP and the people in not the aeronautics division, but in the electronics division at General Mills thought, this is for us. This is a great way to have, we have money, we have engineers. This seems fun. It seems profitable. We can build a submarine. And they did it in Minneapolis, in one of the same facility that made their, not the cereal, but made the machines to make the cereal. They made a submarine called Alvin that can go deeper than most of the subs we have. It's got arms. It's a bunch of great stuff on it. And the Navy is paying for it. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute is owning it. General Mills is making it.
Now, I'm familiar with Alvin because as a Generation X child and a fan of Jacques Cousteau, Alvin appeared all the time as a generally peaceful little friend that went down and did peaceful little friend things.
An incredible little guy, DSV Alvin. And it turns out it was funded by the Navy to look for lost nuclear weapons primarily. That was its main job. So they'd built it. They put this out in 64. The Navy wanted to have this for certain search and rescue type missions. It is a free diving, self-propelled deep sea submersible. They did a really good job of it. Shortly thereafter, they lost a bomb in the sea outside of Spain, and they called Alvin in, and Alvin found it. So Alvin saved us from a nuclear oopsie in 1966, possibly saving a lot of lives, possibly saving the whole world, depending on how much you want to say it would have happened if that bomb had gone off or gotten into the wrong hands. But the Navy let it live at Woods Hole, do all its cute stuff, Jacques Cousteau stuff, but they could call it in anytime they needed it for a Navy mission. And that's how they brought it in, and it found the bomb. And then the Navy brought a different submarine of their own to collect the weapon, dropped it again while they were picking it up, lost it, and Alvin came back and found it a second time.
Oh!
Incredible work from this little guy.
What is Alvin? What technology did General Mills stumble upon where Alvin is besting the U.S. Navy at what is a thing that the Navy should be great at? Like, how is Alvin finding this needle in a haystack?
First, like, what makes the submarine so good is they did have some good material innovation in the kinds of foam that was used in the sphere.
Made
that
out
was
of
like
corn. Light.
They also have Captain Crunch could come in. Mm. He had a lot of knowledge of the sea.
Oh, the captain.
But he also, to find the bombs, there was also early pilots of Alvin had figured out an algorithm for searching with submarines that was also innovative. So it was using that technology as well as the submarine technology.
Talking about slide
rules.
It's not
best in the Navy. It is also the Navy.
Right.
Again.
Right.
They just want to have it also have peaceful uses so that they can like deny that it's a military thing sometimes.
I didn't think I could love Alvin any more than I already did, but now I'm just like, Alvin was also a spy the whole time.
He was a spy the whole time. Yes.
It's like finding out that Chuck Barris was also a CIA assassin in addition to hosting the greatest game show of all time, Gong Show.
I don't know if that would make me love him more. This is one of the things I love about Alvin is that he was a Navy technology that was not used to attack things. He could only look and help and search and pull stuff back. He saved the world. He didn't start wars.
Right. Okay. Well, we both can agree that that is pretty rad.
Well, so, and you know, as an Alvin fan, that Alvin was the submersible on the scene that found the Titanic.
That's right.
Oh, you had forgotten.
No, I was sitting here in my head running down all of the things that Alvin did. And I remember Alvin, you know, being friends with the dolphins, and Alvin was,
yes,
you know, surrounded by people with giant flippers. But then, yes, found the
Alvin also discovered deep sea thermal vents. Wow. Much deeper than we had ever found them before. Alvin is like credited on 2000 scientific papers. Alvin is still in use. This is jumping in a little bit, but Alvin is still in use. In 2014, it explored the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Although, in fairness, it has been like rebuilt and redesigned so many times. There's like a sub of Theseus thing with him, but he's still around doing cool Alvin stuff.
Right.
But if we go back to the 60s again, in 1968, we had another Broken Arrow event. This time, we lost a nuclear submarine, the USS Scorpion.
Yes.
This Skipjack class nuclear sub, it just doesn't come home one night.
Right.
I remember we freak this. Out. We send out the cavalry. We have 55 ships, 35 planes. Everybody's searching for her. They can't find her. But you know who found her?
The Russians.
Alvin found her.
Alvin again.
You're so close. Alvin came in. So we used the SOSUS array that I mentioned earlier, where we can spy on stuff underwater to find about where we think it's going to be. We use the hydrophones, like between the whale sex sounds, they like hear where the submarine probably is. And they use Alvin and its search algorithms, and they find where it is. And Alvin takes some like pictures from above. We have a pretty good idea of where it is, but it's really deep. We can't go mess with it or anything.
This is like down between Alaska and Hawaii, right? Or it's south of Alaska.
No, sorry. And Alvin is not here yet. I skipped a part, but no. But this is in the Atlantic. This is in the North Atlantic.
Okay.
So we found it in 68 after it happened. We triangulate. We know where it is. We actually had audio from the hydrophones of the implosion, which is like really horrifying.
Hmm.
15 years later, we lost another nuclear sub, also in the North Atlantic, the Thresher. And the Navy decides that we know where they are. We know the Russians didn't take them, but we want to learn more about them. Why did they go down? Were they shot? What caused the implosion? Did the crew survive for any amount of time? Like, the Navy decided in the 80s, they wanted to learn a lot more about it.
Is this the one where they built a ship that looked like just a regular ship, but in fact it was a sub salvaging ship?
That's a great question. I don't know if that's the same story.
I think that's a different story.
That would have been at the time. Yes, that sounds right for the time when they first found it. But we're cutting to the future now, where we want to get more information about it. And that's when we send Alvin down. So Alvin was not there on the original mission. That was your boat. I got that confused a second ago. Alvin goes out later in the 80s. They want to go look at these ships, but they don't want to let the Russians know they're still down there and that there's still missiles in the tubes and there's a nuclear reactor. So we don't want them to know they're doing it. So instead of being secretive with a fake ship and a submarine into it, the Navy comes up with the plan of bringing in the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Alvin, and Robert Ballard, and says, I need you to find the submarine for us and investigate it with Alvin and get really down in there. And Robert Ballard says, can I also look for the Titanic? And they're like, here's what we'll do. We'll do the Titanic as a cover story. We'll tell people we're looking for the Titanic. We're not a military organization. We're just checking out the Titanic, but we'll secretly be using that as a cover to go look for these submarines. And Robert Ballard says, yes, but only if I can look for the Titanic during my off hours. And they say, sure. So they finish the mission photographing and examining the sunken submarines. And in his spare hours after that, Robert Ballard uses Alvin and actually finds the Titanic. And at the time, the Navy was pissed because they were like, this is the kind of attention we don't want. This was supposed to be a cover story. We fail. Oopsie, no Titanic. But all of a sudden, there's way more attention on this project than they ever had. But they also got some good publicity. They're like, we helped. We let them use some Navy stuff to go find the Titanic. How cool is that?
Yeah, at some level, hiding in plain sight is also a strategy. And the world was so thrilled. I'm sure even in Russia, I'm sure Brezhnev, no, he would have been gone. I'm sure Yuri Andropov was also like, they found the Titanic.
That's crazy. Yeah, super cool. And it probably did not say, I wonder if they also found a submarine down there when we were looking for it.
So the sunken submarine was close enough to the Titanic that
The two submarines, both the Scorpion and Thresher, USS Scorpion and Thresher, were near enough in that it was in the general search area where they were pretty sure the Titanic was, and they were able to do all of that on the same outing.
So did anybody think for a moment that there might be another Bermuda Triangle, but it's like the Newfoundland Triangle or something where the
Navy didn't mention this, and I think that is in itself suspicious.
Yeah, typical.
General Mills got too much serial money and they found the Titanic and they averted nuclear war multiple times. The only thing that I promised, and they found, they caused the Roswell incident. The only thing that I promised at the beginning that I haven't told you yet is they also invented Olive Garden. And that is a more obvious connection. They had unlimited flour. It makes sense that they would get into the breadstick business. But those are the three biggest side quests of the generalist of Mills.
So what I want to know, I guess, is how is it that General Mills isn't widely known? Why do we not talk about them in the same breath that we say Northrop Grumman or, you know, there are a lot of companies, I guess Northrop Grumman, bad example, because they always made airplanes. And so, you know, the fact that they make cruise missiles isn't like crazy, or Boeing or whatnot.
I mean, yeah, Boeing is like maybe a good analog where we talk about Boeing as making civilian planes, not about their rocket programs and their missiles and stuff. So we just it's because you're just not in the market to buy a B-52 or whatever. Like, you're just not getting those other products. You're not in the market for a deep sea submarine. But what's great about them is that they have, like General Mills has the best cover story for their business, where you don't have to ask about their submarines. You don't have to wonder if they were making ethical decisions during the Cold War, because the cereal's good.
Right. And if you do see a captain walking down the hallway at General Mills, you could legitimately say, is that Captain Crunch? And they're like, oh, well, he's auditioning.
I mean, it was this, like, there was this time, especially with military money, but also just like with companies that got unbelievable amounts of money in the mid-century, where they were like, let's try everything. And I read an interview with somebody who was working at General Mills in research at the time. It was like, yeah, the attitude to people was, if you had an idea, they would fund it. Like, the attitude they had to their employees was like, sure, we could enter that business. And now they've divested from all of this. They don't own Olive Garden anymore. The submarine stuff is all gone. They've focused back on their cereal brands. They bought Pillsbury and combined the cereal brands. So there was like a time of expansion and contraction, and we were like in sort of a contraction on the side quests. But I'm sure it's going to go back out, where our like bread companies in 2030 are going to be like, we should try to make nukes.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions, Alex. First of all, are you a millennium or are you a Generation X?
I am a decrepit millennial. I'm an old millennial. I'm the oldest millennial allowed by law. So I'm just on the cusp of X.
So 1980, 81.
Yeah, right in there.
Yeah. So as a millennial, as an aging or aged millennial.
Yeah.
Who presumably says the words late stage capitalism as part of just cocktail party conversation.
Yeah, I would never go to a party, but yes, theoretically.
Yeah, right. Lately, as many of you know, I've been a lot more intentional about what I wear day to day. I've been, you know, kind of curating pieces, leaning into pieces that feel easy and comfortable. I like to look put together. I like getting dressed to be simple, but I still like to have tons and tons of style, and I've been really psyched to have discovered Quince. I've ordered some products from them. The fabrics really feel like elevated. The fits are clean. Everything works without needing to overthink it. Quince has a great menswear selection, which is not true of everywhere. It also has housewares. It has a lot of stuff for all genders, and it has really cool. This is a great time to go on Quince because it's got all their spring lineup. Think about that look, that European sort of linen shorts and shirts, kind of late spring throughout the summer, lightweight, breathable, comfortable, but still like really chic. The thing about Quince is that their garments are priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd normally expect for items of this quality. And it's because Quince works directly with ethical factories It cuts out the middleman, so you're getting premium materials without the markup. Just go. Just go to quince.com and you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, the vibe is really impeccable. Like, I actually got some housewares from them. I got towels. I got, like, stuff for the bathroom. Floor, like, really nice, luxe kind of bath mats. Like, Quince has really got a lot of stuff going on. So refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/omnibus for free shipping on your order, 365-day returns. It's now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/omnibus for free shipping, 365-day returns. quince.com/omnibus. Do you look back at a time when General Mills was like, hey, you know what? We should secretly become a military contractor and hide behind cornflakes. Do you look back at that and say, that was a kind of American capitalism that is differentiated from now by the fact that these days that extra cornflakes money or cereal money, cornflakes is made by Post, right? So that's a different...
Kellogg's,
that's right.
Their thing was that they didn't go on a side quest away from cereal. The cereal was a side quest. The Kellogg's brothers, their whole thing was trying to get people to stop having sexual urges.
Right.
And so they invented bland foods, including cornflakes. And then famously, the brothers fell out because one of the brothers wanted to add a little sugar to cornflakes. The other one didn't because he thought it would make people too horny. And so the cereal was their side quest away from their focus on fake health and sexuality.
But it seems like the critique of late stage capitalism is that all of these companies that manufacture things, they have begun to think, it's been a while now, but think of themselves primarily as a thing that manufactures money. And whatever it is that they're actually making is sort of a side quest. Their real goal is to make money and to enrich other people that have money. And so when you think of it from your perspective, do you feel, even though you're a peacenik and a vegetarian who doesn't presumably think that cereal companies should be making space lasers, would you prefer that, or do you think of it as a golden era compared to, say, Elon Musk, who's on a million side quests, but all in the service of what one imagines is just Bond villain level, across the board sort of evil? Was General Mills trying to do the right thing? Is it an example of corporate sort of policy that is better or worse?
I do find the idea that you have so much money from your core business that you're like, let's bring in scientists and let's do research and invent things, is much more charming than, say, like a Nestle now, which is sort of like has some similarities as a food brand, but they're like, we don't make anything. We are just a company that owns brands and markets our own brands. And then we subcontract out the making of our things and that we make sure people don't get water because we don't believe water is a human right, that kind of thing. But they like focus on that. But they're not like inventing cool stuff. And the fact that this was, the money went towards science and research and inventing, I do think as a late stage capitalism, one of the things that happened from 1950 to now is that the expectations of profit margin and that much being returned to your shareholders has gotten much higher. So this company was throwing off money. They used it to build additional businesses and hire additional workers. And a company now would be like, how can we shrink what we do and take the money for us? And right. So, yeah, I do think I'm so skeptical of any sort of nostalgia, especially corporate nostalgia. But I prefer reading about Alvin and his adventures to Nestle and theirs.
Right. I mean, one thing missing from the story is the name of the CEO of General Mills who became a billionaire and who, you know, ended up
absolutely
being a monster because the money was going back into Yeah, like you say, hiring scientists. And you and I are living in a world where out-of-work scientists are, you know, at every street corner holding up a sign like, we'll operate centrifuge for money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think that has a nostalgic bent to it. I think that does seem a little bit nicer. I think, like, Tesla's an interesting example where SpaceX is, like, almost entirely funded by government research grants the same way, essentially, or contracts.
And fully making things, like making things hand over fist.
Yeah, yeah. I do like that. And there was a time when we all thought this is a neat thing. They're taking this government contract of money for rockets and they're building cool new technologies. And then at some point it was like, actually, this is just because I want to be king of Mars. And now we're cutting corners and everything blows up. And like like it's a lot less Tesla. The companies are just like, we're switching into robots now. Like, it doesn't feel like they're making anything correctly or trying to do science and research and stuff. I like when people make stuff. That this is how I end up on capitalism, which is like weird, but I do like people making stuff and inventing things and having ideas. So that's what I look for. And if I'm going to be comfortable with a part of capitalism, if you make me a desk and I hand you money for it and I get a desk, that feels like cool capitalism. I like that I don't have to learn how to make desks.
It does.
So I'm glad. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the kind of capitalism that, that doesn't make you lie awake at night going like, are they coming for my blood?
And this is the through line of a lot of what, like when I talk about corporations and scams, which is like a big through line in all of my, my work is how scammy all corporations are now. That comes up in my TikToks all the time. But the thing I like is like a boutique, vintage capitalism where somebody gets good at making something and you pay them for it. And it is really lovely to be able to say, I didn't learn how to make desks. I learned how to tell jokes on TikTok and I get a desk and we've traded those two skills. Like, that's what fun.
Right. I bought a pair of salt and pepper shakers from this Goodwill. I gave them to that Goodwill. Everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as they're not using that money to enrich the CEOs, which is where people were mad at Goodwill.
Yeah.
If they were using it to invent submarines, they would have my Goodwill.
Exactly. I mean, this was a problem. My mom used to volunteer for United Way. And then it was a kind of similar feeling of like, wait a minute, United Way uses 89% of their money to pay for administration.
Yeah.
And why are we donating to them, even though they, at one point in my life, were considered the gold standard of nonprofits?
Yeah. And I'm glad that we are like more aware of how that works. I think I also think we're like, when the people who are like the billionaires are like, I'm going to give away my money, but only when I find the perfect place. That's not that helpful. Just give it to somebody. Let someone else work with it now. It doesn't have to be perfect. Like, I'd rather United Way have it than Elon Musk, but they might not be as good at it as your local grandma thrift store, which is going to use it to just help the people in their community.
So you've taken us all the way to the mid-80s where General Mills is finding submarines, finding the Titanic, which is a huge gift to all of humanity.
And especially to kids who were like 14 in the early 90s before the Titanic movie came out, when we were still just watching documentaries about finding the Titanic. Oh, what a time to be alive.
What a time to be alive. I mean, I wasn't a little kid. I was already, somebody that was smoking marijuana. But I can tell you right now, to be in your early 20s and stoned and watching Titanic footage,
incredible.
What a dream.
I do feel like Leonardo DiCaprio made it less fun to care about the Titanic, but man, between when they found the Titanic and when that movie came out was just every channel, every night, there would be some video about a TV show about the Titanic. Oh, it was great.
I just watched the Titanic movie with my teenage daughter because it seems like a rite of passage, even though her mother, who's a film buff, was like, I hate that movie and I think that watching it is you know, a crime against culture.
Mm.
And we watched it and, you know, it's very beautiful. And of course, Kate Winslet is very beautiful. I've always been a fan, but Leonardo DiCaprio just really is bad. And it's, you know,
it was also every young woman that I went to school with thought he was the hottest thing that had ever happened. And so I can't like him under any circumstance, right. Never again.
But just to wrap up, so General Mills gets into the mid-80s, a time that I remember quite well, and is basically like, you know, is like an octopus covering the globe, and then they invent the ultimate pasta delivery monster.
Yes.
And then What happens? Do they contract? Do they say, like, this, we've gone too far? Do they say, we're not returning enough money to shareholders? Does Congress get involved?
Exactly what happened. So through the 80s and early 90s, they had a restaurant division. They bought Parker Brothers for a little while. They like owned Monopoly.
Okay.
They bought clothing. I think they owned Eddie Bauer for a time.
Oh dear.
They went all the way. They stretched across the globe, and then they started to be like, we should maybe be a, like, not a specific mill, but maybe not this general. And so they started pulling back. They sold off. They got rid of their research divisions. They got rid of their restaurants. They spun everything off and are now more focused on breads and cereals and mostly, like I said, they're like not even on the manufacturing of those. They're mostly focused on marketing their brands. They're a company, a portfolio of brands and a marketing company largely.
So they've become just part of corporate capitalism, where it was all about downsizing for a while, and then it was just about we don't even care what we make. We just
and they do the same thing where they're like, oh, this year our new idea is pet medicine, and then they'll like buy up all the pet medicine companies, and then 5 years later and fire all the people, and then 5 years later they're like, we should divest our pet industry. Like each new CEO has to either buy a bunch of companies or divest all the other, spin off the companies, and they just go back and forth forever. And it's just CEOs and shareholders talking.
One of the things about the transition from Omnibus 1.0 to 2.0 is I don't know if you follow the career of Ken Jennings, but you know he's a mainstream celebrity, but mm-hmm. Ken is also surprisingly woke. And in fact, more woke than me based on the 5-year age gap between us, because, you know, I was born during the Johnson administration. So still a little bit ambivalent about the fall of Saigon, you know, whereas he later is like, you know, oh, no, Transformers or whatever. But when Ken left, some of the leavening of our relationship went away, and then people realized how desperately woke I actually am in the classic.
You look more woke without him standing next to you.
That's right, because as a classical
you were
liberal,
a 6 and he was a 7, and so people just notice him.
But now I seem like a 9 because I talk about things that seem just to me to be reasonable and based in science, but there's always that 5% that's like, why don't you stop talking about, you know, submarines and get back to whatever, or like, why does Alvin have to be a peace submarine all the time?
Sure, but yeah.
Now that you're here and you can be even more peacenik than me and you know, recreate that energy, what do you imagine as a TikTok hoax debunker is and presumably a supporter of the United States of America and a believer in the Constitution, although that's not necessarily true of all your peers. What do you think the solution to this kind of rapacious, profit-centered bro capitalism? How do we get back to making things and putting money into research and getting away from this kind of cults of personality of rich people? I read something today. There are more billionaires, of course, than ever before, but that Elon is on his way to being a trillionaire. And it just seems like, what's got to give? I don't want to eat the rich. I don't want cities burning.
One of the great things about TikTok is that although you can make longer videos, the ones that do really well are between 60 and 90 seconds. And as luck would have it, that's just a little bit too short for a solution.
Oh,
it's really good for identifying problems. And 2.5 minutes, I could maybe propose a solution, but really I'm not a big solutions guy. I'm a real noticer of things that I think are wrong, and then hopefully someone else is going to solve this later.
Yes, I know, but I detect in you an intellectual curiosity, and you have this breadth, if not depth, of knowledge. And surely when you're sitting in the bathtub, or you know, when someone's leaf blowing outside and you're having your time, you are thinking about things other than just problem detecting.
I do like, well, this is not quite Moon, but I do like, there was that brief window with Lena Khan that it seemed like they were going to stop mergers. And I do feel like monopoly type mergers. And I do feel like when companies are competing, actually, in the theory that capitalism purports, things are much more interesting than when they're not competing. And I do think a lot of that is like that there is a world where government keeps some of these things from being bad and better things happen. And
this is my classical liberalism. This is my old Carter administration. There needs to be regulation.
I do think there's good regulation here would make a big difference. Let me give you a stupid answer because it seems like that's what you're fishing for. So let me give you my stupid solution.
No, come on.
Which is that the thing that keeps these companies able to merge and create monopolies and avoid all of regulation is their ability to lobby. And so I do think that we have to reduce the influence of that money in creating its own legislation. And my theory on that is that any money that lobbyists are taxed at 110%. That's my solution. So anybody who makes money by affecting policy, any money they're paid, they owe 10% more than that to the government. And that is a simple, clean solution you could do that would reduce all of this without having to go to the Supreme Court and do all the other things. If you're a tax accountant, this is another thing, if you do a tax accounting, you should be taxed at 110%. Any money you get paid to avoid taxes should be paid back and then some. I think a couple of 110% tax rates on a couple of specific jobs, you'd clean a lot of this up.
I mean, these are jobs that don't have a huge fan base nationwide. But one of the wonderful things about the last few administrations is that it's very easy to spin that kind of thing into an impingement upon the freedoms of the working class and the farmers who make up the
backbone. I do think that lobbyists would be a group that would be, look, we don't need 100%. We need 51%, right? Or I guess if you're liberal, you need 55% because of the way the electoral college works. But sure. I think if we could get some 55% issues, and one of them is lobbyists should be sad, I think we would have a lot. I think our marketing people could sell it. I also think that in general, the left seems to have better ideas for how to make the world good and worse PR. Yes. So I do also think that we should put a lot more work into PR for ideas that are good and help the world. So perhaps we can take that 100% tax that we took away from lobbyists and use it for also for government PR, for like all the things they do that is like, I think the fact that the Coast Guard saves people from drowning is a pretty cool service that the government provides free.
That's
and
right.
I think they should maybe talk about that more.
Right.
And then we would be more interested in like good regulation and policy. So I think some PR use and less. Those are my silly ideas for now.
As you and I both know, as people, you know, obviously who follow the trades, but also who are against just generally artificial intelligence as a way of running the world.
Yeah.
We know that there are a lot of marketers who are out of work right now because people that run companies are like, why would I hire a marketer when I can have AI do my marketing? And so I think the left just needs to hire all of these out of work marketers at pennies on the dollar for what they were getting paid before.
Well, I think we should pay them reasonable rates. But yes, I think that's a great idea. Take the marketers that are free, bring them in, have them come up with some ways to explain policies correctly so that people will listen and be like, actually, regulation is a great example where like if you ask people if they like regulation, the word is negative to people now on a whole. But if you're like, should food be half sawdust or should you get to know if it's actual meat? They'd be like, well, obviously you should say on the label if it's meat or sawdust.
That's right.
So like people love regulation. They just don't know that that's what it's called sometimes. So I think those out of work PR people come in and they explain how governments work and when it is good and how to make it better. Yeah, I think we could get a lot of progress that way.
Yeah, you put up a poster that says, here's why 8-year-olds don't have to work on Saturdays.
Yeah, right?
And,
right?
You know, that kind of sells itself.
I think so. I think we're not doing a good enough job, but that is exactly right.
I think you have pioneered, or we together have created, another interesting component of the new omnibus, which is at the end of the episode, we just spend a few minutes solving the world's problems.
Solving huge problems.
but solving them in a really pithy way. And then we combine all this pith over time to become a kind of corpus of thinking.
I believe the premise, though, is that the people in the future listening to this recording will be, to them, this will just be a segment of things that clearly didn't work.
Either that, or it'll be one of those things like you go back and look at an interview with Christopher Hitchens from 1992, and you're like, wow, he seemed like a real jerk then, but he seems like a kind of pretty knowledgeable jerk now.
Yeah, maybe that's what, yeah, this segment will be the Da Vinci's drawing of a helicopter for future generations.
And that concludes General Mills, entry 520.GE0615. Certificate number 35593 in the omnibus. Futurelings, you know how we feel about social media. It's very similar to how we feel about AI. It's not necessary. It creates sort of a toxic culture, and we're trying to encourage you never to go on it, except in a couple of instances. One of those is socializing with other futurelings who tend to be among the smartest and most cultured and scientifically minded people really on the planet, but in particular on social media. Just go search futurelings kind of everywhere you are. In fact, you could probably go to your nearest Trader Joe's and hold up a sign that says futureling, and within minutes you'll have a crowd around you. We are at Omnibus, or rather the Omnibus Project, in a lot of social media places. On YouTube, you can watch this show, youtube.com/@TheOmnibusProject. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. I highly recommend you go to our website, omnibusproject.com, which has recently been redesigned, and submit an application or a proposal for a co-hosting slot, just as Alex has, and Alex did not submit. In fact, we found Alex at a bus station and said, hey, you look clever.
I was yelling about submarines at the bus station.
Yeah.
So you had some hint that I would have something to say.
Again, I mean, you weren't at a Trader Joe's, but you were, you know, yeah, you did have interesting things to say. Go to omnibusproject.com/submit to propose a show. You can mail us physical mail, which I have an abundance of here, including a Thor comic book that someone intended for Ken, which he thought was hilarious. Go to, or rather, send us mail, care of the Omnibus Project, to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And finally, this show is supported by our listeners on Patreon, at patreon.com/TheOmnibusProject. Alex and I had a marvelous half an hour long sort of a pre-show conversation that, as Alex is quick to point out, is worth absolutely, it was worth $5 an hour, let alone $5 a month.
Yeah, easily worth $1.25 you paid for it.
That's right. And so I would highly recommend that you go there. We have show notes. There are lots of addenda shows for the whole run of the series, featuring television's Ken Jennings, America's Smartest Boy, and other perks, and especially at different tiers, perks that strain credulity, will boggle the imagination, the level of perks available to you. So that's patreon.com/omnibusproject. And so, Alex, on your way to sunnier climes, do you have anything that you would like to pitch? Are you out on tour? You can pitch your TikTok. Tell us about your businesses.
I'm on all the social medias. It is bad for you, but if you're going to be there, you might as well hang out with me. I also have a newsletter that comes out every Friday. That's the Fun Fact Friday newsletter, where I tell you about some stupid thing I was researching and got excited about, which you can find on my website, alexfalcone.ninja. I'm also on tour, so this is coming out. If this is coming out when I think it is, I've got shows in Toronto and Philadelphia and New York all coming up in May. And I do stand-up comedy, but I also have a projector and fun facts and information and segments and a pub quiz that we all get to do together. So all of that available if you come see me live. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you as many goods and cheeses and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.